Today's Teisha will be on case 20 in the Book of Serenity. Case 20 is entitled Dijong's Nearness. Introduction. The profound talk entering the noumenon decides three and weeds out four. The great way to the capital goes seven ways across and eight ways up and down. Suddenly, if you open your mouth and explain fully, take steps and walk, then you can hang your bowl and bag up high and break your staff. But tell me, who is this? Dijong asked Fion, where are you going? Fion said, around on pilgrimage. Dijong said, what is the purpose of pilgrimage? Fion said, I don't know. Dijong said, not knowing is nearest. Verse. Now, having studied to the full, it's like before, having shed entirely the finest thread, he reaches not knowing. Let it be short, let it be long, stop cutting and patching. Going along with the high, along with the low, it levels itself. The abundance or scarcity of the house is used according to the occasion. Roaming serenely in the land, he goes where his feet take him, the purpose of 10 years' pilgrimage. Clearly, he turned his back on one pair of eyebrows. I want to thank everybody for coming here and practicing this morning and sitting so well. Very still, deep practice. So this is one of my favorite koans. If all the other koans were lost, or if all the sutras were lost, this koan contains really so much insight. So we live in an information society. This is like nothing anybody has ever seen before. Right? You can get up in the morning and you can do a Google search and get, you know, like 40,000 entries, right? You know, all ranked. And, when I stop sitting in the morning, I get up and I have a cup of tea and I have my breakfast, and then I have online, I can read the New York Times, I can read the Washington Post, I can read Salon, I can read Slate, there's all this information out there. And, I will go to a restaurant and see people texting, and that's information, right? We're awash in information. And information means almost nothing, right? We're just awash in it. And people develop like craving for information. Right? I had to take my sister-in-law to the heart specialist the other day. And when I went into the room, everybody was on their phones, see them scrolling and flipping and scrolling. And, that's information, right? People crave that stimulation, right? Everybody knows about clickbaits, right? Everybody has clicked on an internet item that has panels that you have to go through, and there's 20 panels so they can get all those clicks, and they can sell their advertising at a higher rate, and so on and so on. That's the world very much we live in, and it's had the effect of making knowledge harder to get, right? So information isn't knowledge. Information is just basically bits bits and pieces of words and images, bits and pieces of sentences, memes, right, floating around. And people crave that. There's no question about it. You know, people will, when I teach classes, you know, I have to say to my students, please put your phones away, because people are just, they crave that information. And there's a really interesting relationship as far as I'm concerned. You know, it's not so much the content, it's just the stimulation, right? Just knowing that you're getting some information. And you know, if you think about knowledge, it's so different from that, right? I mean, you know, to know some, you know, I click through things myself. I don't usually use my phone, but I'll be online, and I'll read a story here and I'll read a story there, and later at the end of the day, I might be talking to someone and I'm trying to explain what I read, but I don't even remember it. I can't say, well, it was. I can't remember what state it was. I can't remember this. I can't remember. I can't remember who said this or did I read it. You know, that's information, right? And I think knowledge is basically something we internalize, right? And we actually internalize it so much that it can become a sort of like an enduring part of us, right? So I can remember reading. I can remember, you know, books I read in college, and I can remember like every scene of those books. And sometimes I teach those books as an English teacher, and you know, when reading these scenes, it's all right there. It's like, oh yeah, I remember reading this when I was 18 years old. Right. That's knowledge, right, as opposed to information. And we are an information society now that's threatening the knowledge aspect of our society, right? You know, lots of people are awash in information, and they don't really, they think they know a lot, but it's not really knowledge. It's not something they internalize, that they live inside of, and so on, and that's creating a lot of problems. People, you know less and less. But we still put, you know, a tremendous amount of importance on knowledge, even though knowledge is under threat, right? And you know, I think in the West especially, we think of knowledge as like the deepest kind of connection to the world. Maybe I'm, you know, so you know, if I read a poem and it moves me, you know, and I hold that poem in my mind, I feel like I really know something. Or the other day I was reading about the fires in Los Angeles, and this person was a geologist and was talking about, he works for NOAA, and was talking about all these changes. And it was so illuminating. You realize the depth of the problem. So there's information, there's knowledge, and then there's wisdom, right? And I think those three things are very different. And I think we confuse them. You know, Buddhism is about wisdom. And I would even go so far as to say that there, you know, we have this phrase in English, words of wisdom. Those are words of wisdom, words of wisdom. Actually, I don't think there are any words of wisdom. I really don't. I think wisdom has to escape from language to be wisdom. You know, there's still a few bookstores around, and if you go to a Barnes & Noble bookstore, they have like a philosophy section, and they have an Eastern philosophy section. And there's all of these books. You know, books on Buddhism are cranked out every day, and people read them, and I think they should read them. That's great. But when we read a book about Zen or a book about meditation practice, you know, when we read an article in Tricycle Magazine or Lion's Roar Magazine, you know, we feel like we're understanding something. We feel, and it's knowledge, right? It's not just information, it's knowledge. And you take it into yourself, and you can carry it around with you, and you can go back to it. And when something happens to you, you can check, you know. So when you're sitting on the cushion, if you've read something about meditation, or you've heard a TED show, right? This is it. This is knowledge too. You know, you can measure your experience against what you've learned, right? And you can feel like, okay, I'm really getting somewhere in my practice. You know, years ago, before the internet and before Zoom and COVID and all the people online right now would be probably sitting in this room. And I remember there was a guy who was coming for a while, and when I would give a TED show, he actually would take out like a pad of paper, and he'd write it down. He'd write down what I said, or key ideas, right? And I kept saying, please don't do that. You know, that's just knowledge. Information is valuable. Knowledge is really valuable, and it's hard to get, and it's hard to keep. And you know, it's hard won. You know, you have to read a lot of books to understand something, right? But wisdom is something else again. And in Buddhism, we have this idea of transcendental wisdom, right? You know, we have a study group, a sutra study group, and we're studying a sutra, and sutras are knowledge. And we've been reading the Diamond Sutra. And, you know, one of the things the Diamond Sutra does is it uses knowledge to show people the limitations of knowledge, right? So the Buddha will say things like, you know, the Buddha has come to liberate all people from ignorance, right, or from suffering. But then he will say, but really there is no such thing as liberation. It's merely called liberation. And if you are in that study group, you might have read these words and been confused, or you might have been frustrated, because the Buddha will say, I am the uniquely enlightened one, but then he'll say something like, but, you know, ultimately there is no such thing as enlightenment. And it's you know, at first it's terrifying almost, you know. According to Buddhist folklore, you know, when the Buddha presented the transcendental wisdom teachings to his arhats, some people actually like had a heart attack. They were so upset by what he was saying. You know, we've been reading early Buddhist texts, and we read about things like early Buddhists loved to have lists of things. So, you know, when we read about meditation, it says meditation works like this. You go to the first jhana, the state of concentration. Then you go to the second jhana, another state of concentration. Then you go to the third jhana. Then you go to the fourth jhana. It describes all the characteristics of those jhanas. And then it says, now you go to the formless jhanas, right? And in some forms of Buddhism, people actually work with the jhanas. It's like your teacher will say, I want you to go from the seventh jhana to the second jhana. And in fact, in some of the sutras, the Buddha we're actually told, just before the Buddha died, he went to these jhanas, then he went to the eighth jhana, then he went to the second jhana, then he went to the fourth jhana, then he went to the second jhana, then he died. So it's very precise, you know, there's lots of lists for everything. And, you know, when you read the Diamond Sutra, the Buddha would say, he doesn't say this, but it would be like his saying, there are eight jhanas, but they're merely called jhanas. There's no such thing as jhanas, and you're left maybe scratching your head or holding your head. And what the whole sutra is trying to say is, look, knowledge doesn't give you wisdom. Knowledge doesn't give you wisdom. Everything I say, the Buddha actually says, everything I say is just a raft. So, we could argue about whether Buddhism believes in a self or doesn't believe in a self. You know, traditionally, Buddhism has said the teaching of anatta, or no self. You know, basically, that most Buddhists say, yes, there's no essential self. And we can argue about it. Some Buddhists might say, well, there is a self. In fact, in history, there were Buddhists who actually felt there was a kind of conditional or temporary self. And we could argue about that all day, but it wouldn't get us any closer to wisdom. So what the Diamond Sutra is saying is, you need information, right? You need knowledge, but knowledge and information can't get you to wisdom. And you need those things. It's like a raft that you know, the Buddha says, there's samsara and nirvana. And we've all suffered, we've all been unhappy, we know what samsara is, and we're all hoping for nirvana. And the Buddha says, you know, so my teachings are like a little raft that's going to take you from samsara to nirvana. But he says, actually, you have to let go of your ideas in order to do that. You have to let go of your knowledge. It's very important to study the sutras. I hope you think about joining our sutra group. But it's also the case that there are millions of Americans right now who are buying books on Buddhism and underlining lots of key phrases. And, you know, there's a whole genre of literature called self-help literature, right, where you read somebody's insights, and these are really words, but there are no words of wisdom. You know, human beings have another way of experiencing reality. That's what Buddhism is all about, that, right? You know, when the Buddha set off for enlightenment, he was already in this society where there were all these philosophers. You know, at the time of the Buddha, there were all these schools of thought. These people were called shramana. The shramana were not priests; they were like philosophers, and they were like shaman philosophers, and they argued about everything, and they put a lot of stock in knowledge, but. You know, the Buddha realized that, you know, writing down words of wisdom doesn't make you wise. Reading books makes you knowledgeable, but it doesn't make you wise, right? It's like there's something wrong with the idea of trying to get the wisdom through ideas. Right? So again, I'm not discouraging you from reading books or listening to Tay shows, right? You know, sometimes people will say to me, well, you know, I listen to your Tay show, and I always think, well, good, please do, you know, it's not going to help you with your koan, right? Because in order to, you know, sort of resolve the koan, what you know is absolutely no help. You know, so it's like humans have the ability to construct these things in words or ideas that they can carry around with them, right? But we become limited by that or trapped by that. And when we begin to do meditation, you know, we experience like a completely different way of encountering the world. It's like all of our thoughts and ideas are left behind, and when we watch the breath, or when we, you know, hear a sound, the boundary between ourself and the world drops away. And when that happens, it's really possible for us to change. It's really possible to be changed. And, you know, there's nothing, in my opinion, there's nothing like that in, you know, I love poetry, I read poetry, I read novels, but, you know, it's very much the case that we kind of have like a imaginary change when you read fiction or poetry. And, you know, pretty much after you're done, you're back to sort of your default position, right? But, you know, meditation is about entering this other state. It's like a few weeks ago, a friend of mine's husband died. She's a professor at Rutgers. And her husband was also a professor. And her husband died after having cancer for a while and then going into remission, and they were very hopeful, and then his cancer came back. And when I saw him maybe 3 months ago, I thought he'd made it. I thought he'd beaten cancer, right? He looked so, when he first had cancer and he was going through chemo, he was like white as a sheet. But, you know, when I saw him the last time, he looked so healthy. And I was sort of stunned that he suddenly passed away. You know, when people pass away, they want you to tell them something. They want you to give some information to them or some knowledge to them that will make them feel better. So, you know, religious teachings are full of such things. When somebody dies, you know, you could say, he'll go to a better place. Or, there's so many of these things, right? You know, this is, he's gone on to the next phase. He's, you know, now he belongs to the universe. He's part of the earth. All of these ideas are, you know, somewhat consoling. But, you know, under the surface, when you lose somebody you really care about, I don't think those really help. I think that people hear those and they feel somewhat consoled, but there's a long process of sort of like inner transformation that has to go on, right? And most of that happens at a deeper level than thoughts and ideas. You know, when people talk about like the grieving process, it's actually a deep psychological process of self-transformation. And there's this thing that's happened to you that you really didn't want to have happen to you. And a therapist or religious figure or trusted friend can give you some insights. But really what has to happen is you have to become one with the experience. That's the truth. You know, so when we lose somebody we love, it's the worst possible thing in the world. It's something we definitely don't want to have as part of ourselves. But, you know, the grieving process is actually about becoming one with what's happened. And there's no concept that can substitute for that process of becoming one. And, you know, becoming one with something like that is very difficult because, of course, it's painful. And it also is something we want to reject. So we have a sort of like inner conflict. But, you know, I've seen people go through this process again and again, right? And on the other side, you know, it's like not like the problem has been solved. It's like the person they love is gone. There's no way to make it right. But now this event has become part of who they are. It's like on a deeper level, they've become one with the event. And you know, actually, it's a lot like dying, right? You hear, you might recall that there are these stages of dying, denial, and so on and so on. It's not just about dying. We go through something like that over and over again in our lives with many things that happen to us, right? And we have denial, anger, you know, despair, you know, but, you know, eventually you come out on the other side more whole, more connected, more, believe it or not, more trusting. See, you know, people, knowledge and ignorance, that's something important, right? They go together. But, you know, when you know something, in a way, you disconnect from it. Right. In a certain way, knowledge actually disconnects us. It sounds strange to say. But, you know, when if I am walking through the forest and I see trees, I just say trees, right? If I look more carefully, I begin to notice there's a lot of different trees. And for some of the trees, I don't have a name, right? So you know, trees can disconnect you from the forest, right? When you begin to look closely, you realize this is an evergreen. This tree might be an evergreen. I don't know what it's called. And now you're actually seeing the tree. So, you know, knowledge tells us, you already know what it is. You don't have to look carefully. And I think that what we're talking about is wisdom comes from going through this process, going through a process where you become one with something. And it's like, it's genuinely profound transformation of yourself. And knowledge doesn't ask that of you. Your knowledge doesn't ask that. All you have to do is learn it and hold on to it, right? And you don't have to change. Or doesn't demand that you change in the same way. So you know, we live in an information society, and we also value information, we also value knowledge very highly. But I think in our society, people are starved for wisdom. And when they look for wisdom, they read Marcus Aurelius, or they read the Dhammapada, or they read Plato. Please do, you know, it's really interesting. But actually, that's not wisdom. And I'm always surprised, you know, I have a lot of friends who are really deeply learned intellectuals. I don't consider myself deeply learned, but I hang out with people who are professors who, you know, are really, you know, they speak four languages. It's always kind of interesting to see how much they know. And sometimes it's interesting to see that they're not necessarily very nice people. You know, they have a lot of unresolved issues. They're very envious. They're quick to anger, you know, they're threatened by things, they're very, you know, I'm not saying they're all like this. But you can gain a lot of knowledge and not be a particularly wise person or even a very good person. And, you know, even studying ethics or even studying morality doesn't make you a good person. You know, I think what makes you a good person is being able to go through this process of transformation, of becoming one with, you know. And becoming one with is the essence of Zen practice. It's the essence of Zen, right? You know, so when we meditate, you know, you're watching the breath, that's a basically, your teacher will give you the koan first of breath perception. And people who haven't done Zen, you know, they see the breath going in, the breath going out, the breath going in, the breath going out. They can come into the Dokusan room if they don't know anything about Zen, and they can say it's O2 going in and CO2 going out, you know. For a long time, their knowledge gets in the way of their wisdom. But what happens eventually is, you know, that they exhaust their knowledge, right? You don't have anything more to say about your breath. You feel totally blocked. And then, you know, this happened to me. You know, it took me the longest time to present to my teacher a response to the breath perception koan. He said, watch your breath and tell me about it. And I would go in and I would say, the breath goes in, the breath goes out. I wrote poetry. I tried, you know. It took me the longest time to just sit with the breath until I became one with the breath. And I really had this experience where I realized, you know, it was as though I had become one with the breath. I disappeared and there was just breath. And it's like you feel like you're being breathed, right? Being breathed. And this is like the beginning of wisdom. Right? And it's not about what you know, it's about what you can become. So Zen is really like a path of continuous, like, transformation. It's like we think we're a certain person, and that's knowledge. I'm called Kurt, and so on and so on. But Zen is like this path of transformation. You know, you become one with all of these things in your life, right? And the impulse, of course, is to keep them at a distance, right? Or to control them. So if somebody I know has died, and I'm struggling with that, I could say to somebody, I'm going through the five stages of grief or something like that. But, you know, actually that just holds all of that at bay. That just pushes all of that back. Knowledge creates a distance between ourselves and the thing we're looking at. It does. That's the function of knowledge, actually, I would say. It connects us in a way, but it creates a distance also, right? So I don't know if you had this. They probably don't do this in high schools anymore, but in seventh grade biology in the United States, it used to be the case that in seventh grade you would dissect a frog. I don't know if, I hope they don't do this anymore, but in our school in Virginia, when I was in high school, junior high school in Virginia, intermediate school, they would order like 30 frogs and divide the class up, and we all had, two people had a frog, and we would kill the frog in the way the teacher told us to kill the frog. And then we would cut its stomach open and look at its organs. And in retrospect, I realized that was like, that's like the essence of knowledge, if I may say so, right? So, you know, I had the textbook in front of me. We could look at the picture of the frog's internal organs, and we were supposed to label all the internal organs with little labels. But, you know, frogs, they're so wonderful, right? You know, to become one with the frog is not to cut it up like that, right? You know, you will have to be close to the frog physically, but also you watch the frog until you become one with the frog. You know, in ancient times, people used to do this all the time. You know, I was an anthropology major, and people would say, you know, I became the jaguar, right? Western anthropologists think, oh, he's speaking figuratively, but maybe the person meant, you know, I felt no sense of separation between myself and the jaguar. So you know, wisdom is all about constantly becoming one with things in life that we experience as separate from ourselves or want to keep separate from ourselves. You know, wisdom is really about, it's not even the same as happiness. You know, happiness is something you can have or you can lose, right? But wisdom is about connecting. And Zen is like the path of losing yourself and becoming one with the object of your attention. And that's the way of life. That's the Zen way of life. It's the Buddhist way of life. Dijon asked Phaon, where are you going? Phaon said, I'm going on a pilgrimage, right? So, you know, in China, traditionally, there are these five Buddhist mountains. And on each of the Buddhist mountains, there's like a bunch of temples, and people make a pilgrimage round, right? So they map out a itinerary, and they go to this temple, and they make prostrations at the temple, and then they stay overnight at a temple, and so on. Then they go to the next temple. This is like thousands, even now in China, thousands and thousands of people do this. And so Dijon says to Phaon, where are you going? And Phaon says, I'm on a pilgrimage. And Dijon says, what is the purpose of the pilgrimage? So this is really like, I think this is a really wonderful koan, because, you know, when people go to like the Grand Canyon, right, they want to have a Grand Canyon experience. We've seen pictures of the Grand Canyon. You can hike down the Grand Canyon. When people go to the Grand Canyon, they know they're supposed to look out and feel awe at how vast it is and so on and so on. So what they're really doing is just having the experience they think they're supposed to have, right? You know, it's actually much harder to experience the Grand Canyon in a fresh way, right? Without any preconceptions. I remember hiking down the one side of the Grand Canyon, and it was like a major thoroughfare. People were coming and people were going. Sometimes it was actually hard to walk. There were so many people. And of course, a lot of people go down the Grand Canyon, or used to go down the Grand Canyon, who would get down there and realize they were in terrible shape, and they would have to send these mule trains down to rescue them, and the mule trains would be coming up, and there'd be these humiliated tourists. And at the time, I was so upset. You know, I wanted to have this experience of the Grand Canyon, you know, of like pristine wilderness, right? It was crazy. But I, you know, I hiked down and I was so frustrated, right? So frustrated by all of these people, you know, and I felt like I'm a real hiker. These people are not real hikers. What are they doing here? You know, these are amateurs. I'm afraid that was kind of how I was. You know, I was very arrogant about my knowing how to be out in the wilderness. At one point, somebody was up on one of the ledges playing a flute, and it was reverberating through the. And you know, I didn't appreciate it at the time, but years later, I think I was meditating, and I realized what a wonderful afternoon that was. You know, first of all, that was so beautiful. You know, the guy playing that flute. You know, that in my life there will never be another moment like that. But also, all of these people were having this adventure. They were all trying to see the Grand Canyon, be with the Grand Canyon. And they got, they weren't ready, they weren't prepared. But, you know, if I had been able to be with the experience, if I hadn't had my judgments in advance, you know, I would have been ecstatic, right? I mean, I'm a very different person than I used to be. You know, I go into New York sometimes now, and I just love being around all these people. I don't know them. I don't know what they're doing. I just like being in the flow, right? Just being in the moment with all these people. It's so glorious. I love that. I wish I had been that kind of person when I went down the Grand Canyon. My knowledge got in my way. I couldn't be in the moment. I couldn't be one with the moment. And as I said, years later, I was meditating, and I realized what an amazing, I still remember that afternoon. What an amazing afternoon that was. You know, I was held back by my expectations and my judgments. I was held back by my knowledge, you know, these, I, you know. So we're all sort of prisoners like that, right? I mean, I have had so many experiences with people that I've formed a negative opinion of, actually, initially. And then, you know, gradually realize what wonderful people they are, right? I mean, I mentioned earlier, I work around a lot of people who are very brilliant, they're kind of arrogant. You know, sometimes, you know, my own fears and anxieties have gotten in my way, and I've responded, you know, I've formed very negative opinions of them. And then, you know, you get to know them, and you realize behind their anxiety, behind their pretentiousness and their fearfulness, you know, there's this wonderful person. You know, nobody can tell you that, right? Nobody can tell you that, or they can tell you that, but it's meaningless, right? You know, it's becoming one with. So you know, I think the best thing in the world is to go on pilgrimage and have no expectations. Very hard to do. But Phaon is actually an enlightened person. So when Dijang says, what's the purpose of a pilgrimage? He says, the purpose of a pilgrimage is not to know. The purpose of a pilgrimage is to become one with. See? So these are two enlightened masters. And Dijang said, oh, well, not knowing, that's how you become one with. It's like, you know, nobody wants to lose somebody they love, but when you lose somebody you love, you know, and you become one with the sense of loss and so on, you know, it totally transforms you, I would say, in the best possible way. You know, you become so much more alive and so much more compassionate and capable of love and so on. If you are willing to be one with your sense of loss, right? It's just so true. You know, and actually every experience is like that, right? You know, good and bad. You know, we try to separate ourselves, or we often try to separate, or we're often separated by our expectations. But every time we become one with whatever we're holding at a distance, it's like our world becomes a bigger world, and we become more fluid and more connected and confident. So you know, every time you sit down on the cushion and you go into mushin, you go into emptiness, right? You know, you become one with that emptiness, and then you're working with your koan. Koans so often point to things that we don't want to look at, or things that our assumptions are preventing us from encountering, right? So, you know, people very often, when they're given a koan, pretty much everybody has an intellectual response. They come up with a verbal response, you know, so if I have a staff, I will give you one. If you have no staff, I will take it away. And it's just human nature. Please don't criticize yourself, you know. Everybody tries everybody responds to that by using their knowledge, you know, to protect themselves from uncertainty. And, you know, when you stop doing that, when you exhaust your strategies for doing that, you have to sit with this very strange statement. And you begin to become one with it, and when you begin to become one with it, you it starts to resonate at a deeper than an intellectual level, right? It starts to resonate under the surface of your thinking mind, and it's like it starts to resonate. It starts to activate all of these emotional and all of these memories and all of these emotional, you could say, conditioned responses that are energy habits, right, that are hidden under the surface, begin to, like you could say, vibrate, right? And, you know, so a lot of Zen practice is just being in this state of, this intermediate state of uncertainty. You know, in English we have this great phrase, betwixt and between, right? You're moving from your knowledge somewhere else, which you don't know where, and you just have to be betwixt and between for a while. But what's really happening is you're becoming one with the koan. And as that happens, it begins to activate you on a deeper subconscious level. And it puts you in motion. You begin to change. You cannot work with your koan without being changed. That's why Zen is so tough, right? You know, you can read a book and you can not be changed. You know, you can study sutras and not be changed. But there's no way to work with a koan and not be changed. If you can't resolve the koan, it's because you're still unable to change, right? Either a little bit, or some koans ask you to change a lot, right? So, you know, we push things away, but eventually, you know, we allow ourselves to change, to become one with the thing we fear or the thing we hate, or the thing we envy, you know, whatever. And we come out on the other side a different person. And every time we do this, we become more fluent and flexible, open and connected, right? So this is the path. We're all on this pilgrimage together. That's why we all got up this morning and sat on our cushion. And we all know, even if we don't know intellectually, that there's a difference between information and knowledge and wisdom. And wisdom, knowledge doesn't require us to change. That's why we like it so much. And information definitely doesn't like it. It requires us to change. But wisdom has nothing to do with knowledge. It has to do with transformation. Okay. The profound talk entering into noumenon decides three and weeds out four. That's knowledge. The great way to the capital goes seven ways across and eight ways up and down. That's a map. No knowledge, no map. Suddenly, if you open your mouth and explain fully, take a few steps and walk, then you can hang your bowl and bag up high and break your staff. But tell me, so you think you know everything, right? Because but that's just knowledge. Not that your knowledge is wrong, it's just that's only knowledge. But tell me, who is this? Dijong asks Feon, where are you going? I'm on a pilgrimage. So, what is the purpose of a pilgrimage? See, Feon's deeply enlightened. He says, not to know. Not to know. Dijong said, not knowing is closest. Now, having studied to the full, it's like before. Having shed entirely the finest thread, he reaches not knowing. Let the thread be short, let it be long, stop cutting and patching. Going along with the high, along with the low, it levels itself. We change. We become one with. The abundance or scarcity of the house is used according to the occasion. Roaming serenely in the land, he goes where his feet take him. That's a person who's wise, right? He knows how to transform. The purpose of 10 years pilgrimage, clearly he turned his back on one pair of eyebrows.